Welcome to the Faith Film Fan Podcast. Today we're talking about the film The Hopeful, going to be in theaters on April 17th and 18th. And I have the director of the film, Kyle Portbury, here with us, direct from Australia by way of Tampa. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Yes, and well pronounced on my name too. That was excellently done. It's not like we coached each other on that prior to getting
Portbury. Portbury.
Yeah.
B-U-R-Y. Portbury. Portbury. Portbury.
Portbury. We were talking about. So I used to live in Texas, and that great pronunciation of your name is Portbury, was always much mirth. Particularly to my wife, who dislikes highly people saying Barry on the end of her name.
Port Barry.
She had a really great. Yeah, she lucked out actually, because when we got married, she went from being a three-letter surname to like one that's got eight all of a sudden.
That's so it.
She took a real burden.
Well, Kyle, welcome to the show. We're talking about the film The Hopeful. The Hopeful is a basically, it's a history of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, how the Seventh-day Adventist Church came about, how it came to be. You've got filming. I don't know where it was, but I mean, you've got costumes, you've got era pieces. I mean, which does, none of this looks cheap. So let's start out with what led you to want to make a film on the history of the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Well, I mean, histories are always about people, right? And these people are really, really richly fascinating. And they had lives that, and it's interesting, like when you start doing research, this period of time, people wrote, right? Like they wrote to each other. So the correspondence that you have available to you to just kind of dig into and really get a sense of who these people are, leads you down a pathway to go, oh man, there's some really great character story in here, eh? Like there are really like relatable and actually real people who you can recognize as having the same struggles and challenges and loves and losses that you do. And as soon as you recognize that as a filmmaker, you're like, I got something to work with here now, right? Like, because if it's just the history of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, snooze fest, right? Because then it's just going to be a this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened and some stuff got made and we built some buildings and like rah, 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 right? Like, which sounds really great from a, like if you were doing like a corporate pitch on what, you know, what this faith is that you hold. But I think from an individual, like personal point of view, like it's got to be more than that, right? Like it's actually got to resonate more than just like some buildings and a place that we go and hang out on the weekend. It's got to embody something that really provokes you, right? Like that's part of our Christian journey, is to be provoked constantly and challenged in the way that we think and do things. So particularly three of these characters who are real life people, just really grab your attention. And one of them, Ellen, who, you know, fast forward 180 years later, Smithsonian recognizes her as one of the 100 most influential Americans of all time. Her legacy is the largest Protestant healthcare network on the planet. It's the second only in healthcare networks to the Catholic Church. So go figure that. We're talking like 700 plus healthcare organizations, including hospitals and clinics in 65 plus countries. There's a development humanitarian and relief agency that operates in 125 countries, ADRA. And so you've just,
she had a lot of writings too, didn't she?
Wasn't huge, she one of the, amount. She's huge, yeah, amount. She's the I believe, and those of you on Google,
we're talking about Ellen Harmon White. Ellen White is who.
White, yes.
Yeah. Ellen G. White. Is that?
Yeah, so her middle name was Gould. So like when she got married to a guy called James White, obviously became what she's known as today, which is either EGW or the original EG, or Ellen Gould White, or just EG White. So like if you had Google her, she's, I believe, and I could be proved wrong on this, but I believe she is the most translated female nonfiction author of all time.
Yeah, lots of writings.
Again, For a person who has a third grade education in the mid 1800s, to have that legacy, I mean, if that's not inspiring on any level, I mean, other than just like sheer perseverance and determination to not just stick with your station and what you're given in life to work with. I think, I mean, what an incredible legacy for someone to leave.
So did you personally come to this film, you know, as an outsider of the Seventh-day Adventist faith, kind of looking at it as an outsider, or did you come as someone, as a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, kind of coming in that way, saying, hey, this is an important story, we need to tell this story?
Yeah, as a very cynical, skeptical insider, actually, because that's what happens when you're a lifelong anything, right? Like you go through those transition periods coming out of your teen years, and you go to university and you start to question, is this faith that my parents gave me one that I'm going to continue to choose? You know, so you go through that whole wrestle and struggle and, you know, doubting whether or not like this is even something worth bothering with. And then you come out of that, there's only two choices, right? You either come out of that period of time going, yeah, this isn't for me, or you find your adult way of entry into it, and it becomes real and personal for you rather than just a series of rituals or traditions that were handed to you. And that's not to say that my parents did a bad job, right? They're fabulous at the way that they trained up their children. At least I hope they would think that. But I think you have to make that adult decision for yourself, right? Like you have to have those wrestles and those doubts and those struggles and go, this is how I view the world through that worldview. And I think for me, like that became really clear in my late 30s. I'm now in my my tender age of my mid 40s, Rick. But in my late 30s, I think what I came to the conclusion of is that worldview simply for me was the very simple, clear character of Christ as being hope bringer and healer, right? And so everything that I look at now is judged through those two lenses. You know, how am I bringing hope, or how am I helping to heal the people in my immediate sphere of influence with whatever it is I'm doing? So, like, I judge everything by that. And what's fascinating is when I started looking at this story and really deep diving into these characters' lives, that is literally what they discovered that made them so excited about, you know, the unfortunate misconception that he was going to return, right? First of all, they found a guy called William Miller, almost gets blown up and killed in the War of 1812, Revolutionary Wars. And he comes back home. He's the only one that survives this explosion that happens. Everyone around him dies. And he does that classic thing that we do when big events happen. We go, why me? Right? And so he's a deist at this point. He believes maybe if there is a God, he kind of set the thing spinning off in space and then just, you know, left us to our own devices. So very not interested in a religious explanation for this. So he did all of the, you know, the research. He was very well read. He was a gentleman farmer. So he dug into places like Voltaire and Robespierre and looked at all those great French revolutionary philosophies. And almost in desperation, because he didn't find anything satisfying in that, he's like, he finally just went, all right, I'm going to tick the Bible off just so I can get it out of the way. Right. And then in his words, he said, and I found a friend in Jesus. Right. And I think that there's something quite beautiful about the simplicity of that. And whatever you think about like the prophetic miscalculations that he made,
Well, for people who don't know, William Miller was a farmer. He was reading Daniel 8:14, where it said 2,300 days, and the sanctuary would be cleansed. So he saw that as 2,300 years. He dated Daniel to, I think, 457 or something. And so he was doing the math. And so then he said, okay.
Isaac Newton had highlighted that as well. And
Jesus
so he's
is
like,
going
he's
to.
cross-referencing.
Yeah.
And,
So he said, Jesus, then he took that as years. And Jesus is going to come back 1843. Forgot to count the zero when he didn't come back 1843. Then he, okay, now it's going to be 1844. And then they than Ellen White had a vision of why that was, but that's who he's talking about. That's what he's talking about, what they call the great disappointment there.
Exactly. And this comes out of a period too in US history that's kind of largely been forgotten, the Great Awakening. So there's a lot of wrestling with religious and Christian tradition at this period of time in the US. So, you know, a lot of faith traditions come out of this period of time. So it's a really
Mormonism
rich,
comes out, Jehovah's
Mormons
Witness.
Mormons come out, Jehovah's Witnesses, you know.
A lot of things are happening at this time, yeah.
Yes.
Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah, and so that, you know, Miller's Baptist at this point, he becomes, that's where he affiliates. But then he soon realizes that, you know, what he's talking about doesn't fit comfortably into any of those traditions. And, you know, so he kind of gets forced to go out and start telling his story and his discovery, but really focuses on that character of Christ, right? Like he's really, really focused on that that very simple hope and healer friend in Jesus that he found. And that's the first time Ellen encounters this. She sees him speaking in her local church. And that's what she locks into. And in fact, she says to her parents, and, you know, we've got a whole scene in the film about this where she goes, you know, I've never heard Jesus described as a healer before. I've heard of his wrath and his judgment, but his healing is just absolutely beautiful, you know. And I think at this period of time, and this is what's fascinating to me, right, in life, life does this to you. You know, you look at history and then you look around you and you go, wow, this is repeating itself, right? Because if you look around at a lot of the rhetoric that we're hearing in 2024, it's very Christ character as judgmental, and there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of prejudice being spoken in that character, you know? And so you get this real sense that we're in a very similar period of time at the moment where we just need to remember the simple character of Christ's truth, which he is hope bringer and healer. And that is our task. And that is our, I guess, our offering to the world around us. Because any of the other messages, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, you can get fixated on, you know, end times, judgment and all the rest of it. But I mean, I don't know about you at the moment, Rick, but I don't really, you know, I've got enough end times judgment staring at me in the face when I walk the streets. You know, like I don't need to be bombarded in the magical mystery room that is cinema with any more depressing themes, right? Like I actually want to go in there and I want to wrestle with stuff that's going to give me a little bit of a sense of, so the world might not be okay, but I can bring a little bit of okay back into the world through that hope and healing character of Christ, right?
Yeah.
That to me is the beautiful message that these people actually encapsulate. It's why they went through this period of anticipation that got met by disappointment that then forced them to persevere and rediscover that, oh, it was always about this simple character of Christ, right? And we just did what the, you know, when you look at it, it's very similar to what the first AD Christians did, right? They had an expectation of Christ. And it didn't meet up with the actual reality of what he was trying to teach them, you know? And I think there's something beautiful about that when you realize that there can be a beautiful outcome from your terrible mistakes, you know?
Let's talk about the film. Let's talk about the filmmaking.
Yeah.
So we're in early 1800s. Everybody's going to have to wear a costume, all right?
Oh,
costumes aren't so cheap,
fun.
Right?
No.
We're going to have locations that don't have telephone poles and, you know, cell phones, right? We're going to have to find locations. I mean, talk about the filmmaking
really
of this. I mean, we're in early America. Where was this filmed? And, you know, just talk about some of the budget concerns as well. I mean, this is all expensive stuff we're talking about now.
Yeah, it's, you know, period work is so much fun. But yeah, as you said, like it has a heavy lift component to it as a result of that. So like we scoured the globe actually to try and find somewhere to do it and actually found a period village. It's a living history museum just an hour south of Ottawa in Canada on the St. Lawrence River. So it literally looks across into the northeast of New England, into upstate New York, which is where a lot of this story actually physically takes place. So it's perfect because you're looking at territory and terrain that looks exactly like you would hope it would. And so, you know, this village came about. So they flooded the St. Lawrence River, I think, in the middle of the 19th century, so that they could float the big oil tankers and stuff up the St. Lawrence and go up into, you know, the lakes and stuff. And so this, they took all of these old buildings and they stuck them on this property. And then a couple of years later, someone was like, I know what we could do with these. It's like, let's make a living history museum out of it. Like, and thank goodness that they did. It's got some incredible stuff on there, like woolen mills and flour mills that operate exactly like they did. And they grow their own wheat and they make their own butter on site as they did in the 1800s.
They let you film incredible. There? I mean, have there been other movies filmed there?
I think there's been a few, but I'm not sure that there's been any that have been quite on the scale of this. This was quite a big production, and it had some challenges in and of itself because we could only shut down certain areas of the museum at a time, right? And it's still open to the general public in those other areas. And so during the hours of 9 to 5, you couldn't have motorized transport on site because it ruined the feel of, like, you didn't want to hear motors going. And so we've got some fabulous, it's just some fabulous stuff where you've got grip and electric department literally pulling things on like 1800s hands carts that are on site. They're like, yeah, you can use that. Or they're transporting things on horse and buggy to and from set. And I mean, it was fabulous. Like, it really actually transported everyone into that period because, you know, you had to live and work between 9 to 5. And like, obviously we would work outside of those hours, but during that was actually fabulous. It was an actual gift. Like, we had to work harder, but it was a gift.
Do you mind sharing what your production budget was? I'm very interested.
Yeah. So production was about $3.5 US.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you get $3.5 million? I'm a filmmaker. I'd love to know how that happens.
Well, look, and again, that's, you know, part of the history of this. So The Hopeful was filmed at the same time as a 6-part miniseries that I filmed as almost like a work for hire for the church. And so part of that negotiation with them was, hey, there's a really great, I mean, you guys aren't going to want to make that film because it's not, you know, it's not a client deliverable, right? Like, you can't do The Hopeful as a client deliverable. So what I pitched to them, and it's similar to what I guess like Baz Luhrmann's done with Australia. It's the reverse of that. So he shot Australia in 2008, and then 15 years later, he put out Faraway Downs last year in 2023, which is a 6-part, 6-hour miniseries, right? And that is kind of, you know, it's kind of incredible in and of itself because he went the opposite direction to what I did, you know. So I shot a whole bunch of additional stuff that was just for the film, and then it took me years actually to raise the financing to be able to put that through post-production. There were some other things that we shot. I mean, the great thing about period drama is it's already aged, right? Like, it's already baked in at a certain age point, so you don't have those concerns and worries of, is it going to look dated? Yes, and that's the whole point.
You know? You hope so. I hope
you
it
hope
looks
so.
Dated.
That's like, it should look dated. And then you get fabulous people. Like, I was really fortunate in post-production. Like, we raised a really significant post-budget and got a lot of, like, I was able to use tax incentives and post-production rebate from Create New South Wales and Screen Australia and the federal PDV rebate that they have in Australia, and actually have a substantial like amount of buying power to be able to go in and work with all of the top Hollywood professionals in Australia. So, like, you know, the
so
guy
you Brett, did the post. You did the post in Australia.
Yeah, so I did the post. I moved into the post lounge just after Baz Luhrmann moved out finishing Elvis, and so picked up quite a number of his post-production crew off Elvis.
Post-production so is editing, color correction,
yes,
graphics.
Color correction, yeah.
All that.
All that good
for
stuff.
People, you know, so,
So my colorist, Brett Manson, actually colored Elvis for Baz Luhrmann. So you've got, you know, one of the top 5 colorists in Hollywood coming in and actually sitting in the studio with you there in the color grade suite. We spent 110 hours color grading next to each other.
Wow.
And when I say together, what I mean is we would collaborate on what I felt thematically or the feeling that I wanted to convey. And then Brett would actually use his 25 plus years of experience and take in 90 seconds he would take a keyframe and it would go from looking like a pretty decent like BBC period drama to all of a sudden like you're going, oh my goodness, this is like world-class cinema all of a sudden, like literally that quick in front of you. And it was just, it was one of
amazing what they can do, isn't it?
It was such a rewarding experience because you're working and collaborating with somebody that's just so able and they've been doing it for so long to just be able to take a note of, I want to feel like this, and then translate that into the way he paints light on the canvas that you've put on set together with your cinematographer. And again, like I had an incredible cinematographer, Peter Moss, who's just he's an old school kind of BBC trained, or not BBC trained, British born, and then like started off his career as a dolphin trainer, but then because he was so good with the dolphins, Mike Nichols gave him the underwater camera rig on Day of the Dolphin, and he was the cinematographer then underneath all of the underwater shots on that, and then went from there and was like, you know, camera operator under Don McAlpine on some of the biggest films in Australia and Hollywood then, and you know, just went from there. And so, you know, when you've got these collaborators who are so skilled at their craft, and you can have conversations with them and then come up with ways of constructing both character and also set. So it's compositionally and lighting. You know, one of the things I love in cinema, when you have a look at lighting compositions, for instance, in a frame, there's a classic scene in Jaws, and it's not one of the action scenes. It's Brody sitting there at the table, and he's looking really like down, and his son starts mimicking, right? His hand movements. And it's that famous scene where, you know, Alan Brody walks in and at the end of that scene, Brody turns to his son and goes, give us a kiss, right? So it's this really beautiful little like touching moment. And Spielberg's so good at being able to just spray a little bit of light that has no motivation at all, shouldn't even be there. It's coming from bottom right of screen. So there's no window there to do it. But it's spraying over the back of a like a hutch with some plates in it and stuff. And you look at that and you go, without that little bit of light detail, that scene would feel flat and lifeless. And actually, it's just those little touches that bring that scene to life visually and then allow your actors to walk into a frame that they're then compositionally adding to as well. And so it just... It really works geometrically and just it's just glorious to watch. And I'm a big student of, I love Kurosawa films, the Japanese director who, if you've never watched, there's a really great film that not a lot of people watch of his. Everyone watches like Seven Samurai or Yojimbo or Ran or Throne of Blood. But my favorite one of his is a film called Only the Bad Sleep Well. And the whole thing is shot geometrically. So every single frame and the way people walk into frames is all in geometric shapes. And you can turn the sound off and not even look at subtitles, and you know exactly what is going on with every single scene and every single character, what they want, what they're trying to get from somebody else, whether they get it or not. And you don't even have to listen to a single thing. And so then when you bring sound to bear on that, right? And again, for us, we were really blessed in the fact that like most of George Miller's Mad Max Furiosa team, he pushed his pre-mix on Furiosa a couple of weeks when we were going into final mix and made some space available then in the big suite at Spectrum Films there on the Disney lot in Sydney. And so we were able to mix like world-class cinema level then, which was not probably going to be the case. So big shout out. Thank you, George. I appreciate it. His trailer for Furiosa looks incredible, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. So the audio mixing and all of that, that's all done in pro. I mean,
like world class. I mean, you can't get any higher level. I mean, again, like think about it for me, right? Like here I am, like
you have to be having a good time. You're enjoying. You got to be.
I am literally walking in there going, I don't know why I'm providentially being handed the keys to these doors and why people, like our schedule was really locked. We couldn't move. We didn't have the kind of finances of a mid-budget studio picture. But we were the doors were opened up to a mid-budget studio picture level post-production time and time again. And you would just sit there and marvel and go, man, you can't claim that, right? And this is what I love about that sequence of events, right? Any one of them on their own, you could go, well, that's accidental, isn't it? You know, well, that's just good luck. Like, great for us. We're in the right place at the right time. But when 10 or 20 of them happen in a row in the course of 6 months, like it would be really disingenuous to sit back and go, well, I'm either that clever or that lucky that I could have that many things just go right for me.
Have you ever thought to yourself, it would be great if there was one location I could go to learn about what new Christian movies are coming out, where I could see them, and interesting stories and news about the latest films and stuff like that? Well, guess what? There's a place, and it's called, wait for it, faithfilmfan.com. If you like Christian movies and you want us to make more of them, you got to go buy a ticket because they're not cheap. So plan a movie night out at faithfilmfan.com. You can also find this podcast on there as well. Thanks for supporting films that are worth watching at faithfilmfan.com. And plus, I mean, so you had the Seventh-day Adventist Church. You were doing for them a series, and then using the budget from that to also kind of tag team. So were you filming the movie and the series at the same time? Were you filming
it so some
simultaneous?
Correct, yes. So
the series has reenactments and things.
So the series has some scenes that you'll see in The Hopeful you would recognize if you ever saw the series, right? And so what's fascinating is that when you get, you know, because there's a 10-year gap between those two. You know, so 10 years later, I come back and I finally got the finances, because at that point, you know, it's on you, right? Like, you've got to go and raise money, and then you've got to go raise P&A money to get it onto cinema screens April 17th.
So the filming was all pre-COVID then. You filmed it 10 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. This is all pre-COVID. You didn't have to worry about COVID or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. What we did have to do in August of 2022, just as we started post, I really wanted to keep everything in camera. I didn't want to, because I'd shot everything in camera. It was all done Arri Alexa M pluses with crusty old, you know, Hawk C series anamorphic lenses and this big ingenue, which is about, which had been retrofitted back in the 60s, the 1960s, to be anamorphic and weighed a ton. Like, it had so much glass inside it. And was worth more than the entire camera package, just this one lens, and just glorious. I mean, like, the bokehing, so that like aberration that you get around the edges of screen, and like just the dirtying that it did to digital. Because again, when you're working in period, you want a bit of detritus on your picture, right? Like, you don't want it to be this clean, crisp,
you want it to
digital
crisp
image.
And clear. No. You want it soft. You want a soft image.
Yeah. So I also didn't want to have this huge, I don't know, there's a storyline that runs through The Hopeful that's unique to The Hopeful. And it's very similar, like, construct, I guess, to like Princess Bride. So it's a dad and his two kids on a ship on their way to Europe. And I didn't want a CG ship. There were two reasons why I didn't want one. It's really, really hard to make that CG ship look real on water. Like, just even in this day and age with AI and all the advancements we've got, it still looks fake. And so I looked around. It turns out that most of those two-stack ocean-going steamers from that era that they would have sailed on are either at the bottom of the ocean now or in dry dock or burned to the ground because a boiler exploded in dock or something. And, you know, so there's one left on the entire planet sailing on the ocean. And it sails out of Glasgow. It's called the Waverley. And so just the craziest story of how this came about. So it was, they had a three-hour window that we could hire the whole boat out for. And, I mean, just think about this for a second. So they've got one three-hour window where in Scotland filming. It's just, I couldn't get out of Australia. We just got back in. The borders had not quite opened up properly, and and so we got back into Australia about a year and a half after COVID. We'd been living in Cape Town in South Africa. And I looked at the price of what it was going to cost me just to sit on an economy seat to go and direct that shoot. And it was just like, it was like 20 something thousand dollars to sit in economy. And I'm like, no, A, that's just not a good use of the budget. And B, I also don't want to do that and have to go through like getting in and out of COVID protocols again that have only just relaxed a little bit. So we did all of that remote. Like we had a remote crew, like the guys that shoot all of the aerials for HBO for Succession and stuff up there in Scotland. And they had a follow boat. But then what they don't, nobody tells you is that there's a certain wind threshold that that heavy lift drone can't take off on. And then you're like, oh, wow, we're in Scotland, aren't we? And you know, there's like 300 and something days of rain and wind in that area. It's the Isle of Arran, so it's like really blustery all the time. And you know, so you're sitting there going, so I have a 3 hour window and I'm looking at the weather patterns in the run up to this, and it's like torrential rain every day, all the way through the shoot time and all the way through to 3 days later. So I'm just like, oh, well, I mean, we're just going to have to hope for the best because there's no other option for this, right? So, you know, we get to the shoot. I'm on like on phones with the guys there. I had a producer, my executive producer was able to go there from the US to manage that. He was on the phone. He tells the great story that so they all get out. It's raining. Everybody's setting up the follow boats, getting ready, and they just, you know, he said, I'm just going to pray, right? Just for safety and all the rest of it. So he does that. He has a prayer. Everyone like gets up, goes to work. As the two boats take off to start doing it, the whole cloud cover lifts out and they end up just having this like 3 hours of just the most glorious, perfect weather that you could absolutely hope for to get every single shot. The wind died down. So literally, I mean, we got an hour's worth of like the best 8K drone footage that you could ever have hoped for. Every single thing on the shot list, and then
For
all the playing around
the steamship, that's the
for
one of a
this for the
kind. What?
steamship.
Because yeah,
Yes.
that ship, it did look good. I was looking at it going,
Oh,
okay, that looks real. That
yes.
doesn't look
Yeah.
CGI. That doesn't look CG, you know?
And that's because it's not. It's a real ship. The only thing CG in that, there's one thing, and I won't spoiler alert for you, but you know, if you're sitting in cinemas on April 17 and 18 and wondering what the CG is on that ship, send me a comment on the hopefulmovie.com and see if you're
You took
right.
out the title that was on the side or something, but anyway.
Do you know what? I didn't even do that because you don't like, again, one of those things that we did with Brett. So Ari came out with an algorithm update and then we contacted them and they did this thing. So like normally when you're putting film grain over digital, it like sits on the top of the entire film, like a piece of glass in front of it. And it always looks horrible and looks too uniform. And it just looks like it's a cycle track of noise. And you just, blah, just looks terrible. So in about July of August 22, Ari came out with an ability to, so it took film grain and did with it what film grain normally does when you shoot on film and put it into the luminance levels of the algorithm of the actual log C. So
And
again,
this is in the
I don't
camera.
un
This is
this is
in
in camera.
camera.
So yeah, so I don't understand how this works, right? So I'm saying all these words and it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. I don't know. All I knew is when I saw the test in post-production when this was applied, you literally went, wow, it looks like we shot on 35 because all of the grain is working, you know, so in the areas of the shot where it's darker, the grain operates very differently to the high exposure areas. Like it does exactly what film grain does because
So this is
when
the
light.
Arri Alexa, which is a very, very
Yeah.
expensive digital cinema
Beautiful digital.
camera.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what it's doing is it's emulating, it's getting better and better, making it
Yes.
look like 35 millimeter film, which
If
is
you want that, right? Like if you
right.
want that look, and for us that was a really great look because we've got a lot of like natural candlelight in this movie, right? There's a lot of scenes that were lit with candle or whale's oil lamps or, you know, which is this like fabulous two wick lamp that burned at a certain brightness. And not that there was whale's oil in them in when we shot, but they're called that. And I joked at one stage with the historians who were very adamant that they must be this particular lamp. And they're really hard to source. Like you have to go to my props and art department guys that like really struggle to find these things. And I joked with the historians at one stage when we were struggling. I was like, look, you know, like we can slave ourselves to that. And what else would you like? Do I need to go down to the Southern Ocean and harpoon a whale so I can fill it with the actual oil that they would have used as well? Like, what are we trying to do here? Like, we need to be practical and get, you know, certain things. So, but it was a great joke on set, actually, about those lamps. And at the end, my production designer gave me a little replica one that they'd gotten some guy to hand glass blow in Ottawa, which was magnificent. But, you know, that ship, I think what that taught me, because at the end of that 3 hours, they came back, they put everything back in the truck, shut the back of the production vehicle door, torrential rain, and it rained literally nonstop for another 3 days. You know, and my executive producer, Kevin, tells this great story. He overheard one of the guys saying to the local producer, man, I don't think anyone's ever prayed on a set that I've been on before, you know? And she said, well, it worked, didn't it? And they just wandered off. And I just thought that was a fabulous.
Maybe we should start praying more often.
Look, you know, like it.
Prayer's a good idea.
I gave kudos to Kevin because sometimes it's really difficult, particularly when you're not working with, you know, there was one Adventist on this shoot and in post-production, this guy, right? So everybody else working on the film, you know, may have been Christian, but we had, you know, people of lots of different faith backgrounds and people of no faith, you know, and I think what's really valuable about that is, A, you get to have a great experience with people who don't see the world like you do. So they challenge you in the way you're telling your story, not in a bad way either. Like, they're not influencing me to tell it any other way than how I want to tell it. But they are also, right? Because they'll say to you things like, hey, you know how you said to me this about this thing? Well, it would seem that you're taking for granted this because I'm so used to it, right? Like, I may either be going, oh, that's going to be awkward for somebody. So maybe I won't go quite as detailed in that. Whereas they will go, they'll challenge you and they'll actually make it deep and more rich.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering about that. I know Ellen White, she, for people who don't know, she had about 2,000 visions. She had visions, yes, from God. And so God explained to her what actually happened on October 22nd, 1844, and that, and then also other visions, things like, you know, people who worship on a Sunday are part of the mark of the beast and things like that. How do you tell that? How do you decide, okay, what I'm going to put in and what I'm not going to put in about Ellen White? And because, you know, there's a lot of people who go to church on Sundays, you know, and
sure,
as in the New Testament in Corinthians and, you know, Acts, they're meeting on the Lord's Day, the first day. So how do I tell that and not say, hey, all you guys, you're not going to heaven? You know, I mean, how do you do that? You know, how do you make that decision to what you say and what you don't say?
Yeah, and I think that's the fabulous thing about cinema, right? I think you put out the things that reveal character, and you allow people to decide for themselves how they feel about that, right? You know, I think when we shy away from, like, oh, we better not tell people that, you know, she said this one time in a writing. And you got to remember, it's like the mid-1800s, for goodness sake, right? Like, not everything that she says should you take literally or at face value.
I thought everything she said was scripture, that it was she's
no, prophetic. And No, and she would challenge people on that as well. She often corrected people when they said that about her. She would say, look, my only value is that I point you back to Christ, right? That's it. And in fact, she had this great quote that people tend to forget sometimes, right, where she would say, I am a lesser light and he is the greater. And she would have been quite happy if she'd been completely forgotten by history altogether, right, and just been for that moment and propelled onwards.
So when they say the correct way to interpret scripture is through her, that is not at
no,
all what she,
that's not what she said, what she believed. And she would have been horrified by that. Like, if she saw that spirit today, she would heavily rebuke it, you know. And I can say that because I poured through her archives, right? Like, and I got a measure of the woman, and you got a really clear sense that she understood her place in the grand scheme of things, you know. Like, it wasn't follow me and do as I say. It was, you know, like, I saw this, what do you think, right? Now, she would get very forceful with people. Like, there's a lot of great correspondence where she would call people out. She, very personal stuff. Like, she'd say, brother so-and-so, and I was shown in vision this, and you need to stop, you know? So it's really, you know, that some of those visions are very, very personal to the person and a very specific time and place. And then you've got fabulous ones like the health. She has a health vision in the 1860s. And when you have a look at, you know, our understanding of modern whole food and health and you know, plant-based diet and, you know, all of the veggie meats that we see today find their root in that vision, which is fascinating. So if you're eating a Beyond Burger today, those exist for the most part because of a vision that she had in 1864. Okay. I mean, I think that's kind of crazy, isn't it? Like, you think about that and you go, so this kind of way that we look in the modern era at whole health, you can chart that course all the way back to there. So it has completely moved away from being anything that I guess you would go, well, that came from Adventists, and now is more just like widely accepted in just
right, healthy
in general
eating,
society.
You know, yeah. She had visions of that.
Yeah.
Also then,
so I think those...
So, yeah,
more
so just there's the controversial stuff. I know that she said that
she's human.
That's when Christ entered the Holy of Holies, and that there's this now this investigative judgment going on, so that there was this, you know, it wasn't finished. There's this now there's this other thing happening, and it happened on the day that William Miller said, but he got what he got wrong, but here's what was right about it. So how do you, you know, how do you define, how do you just tell that? Because a lot of people will go, I don't find that in the Bible, you know? So then how do you put that, how do you tell that? Like you said, there are people who were kind of giving pushback, because that to me was what I was thinking. Okay, how do you do this? How do you, you know, how do you tell this? And what's different now in the Seventh-day Adventist Church than what was going on back then? Because that was, you know, 1845, you know, mid-1800s. Lots changed between now and then.
Yeah, and I think the great thing about storytelling is that you get to show the wrestle and the struggle that people are going on with, even just the way that they see the world then. And I think, you know, it's a good mark of a healthy society. So when you're looking at modern Adventism, there's so much debate and talk and discussion about, you know, what they mean and the importance of those. And I think you'll find, you know, if you walk into most Adventist churches today, you'll probably find 90% of the people in there have only ever engaged with her through somebody else telling them that I once read a quote of, you know. And so it's only in the, I think if you get the opportunity like I did to kind of pour into there, the archives and the research, where you get to make your own mind up about it, right? Like, that's the fabulous thing about looking at history and reading stuff that other people have written and their experience, because what it allows you to do is go, oh, that's fascinating, or that bit doesn't quite gel with me, so I'm going to go on, I'm going to do my own research biblically or whatever and have a look at that. And then I get to decide how I feel about that. Nobody tells me how I should think or feel or do in response to it. She has one. I'd never read this book until 2 years ago, when I had to direct. So Tommy, who plays Ellen in the film, did the audio book for a book called Steps to Christ, which is her most widely translated book. I think it's in like 100 and something languages now, wow. You know. And it's really a love letter sonnet almost to the character of Christ. And you look at that and you go, and she wrote that really late in her life. You know, she, you know, quite towards the end before she passed away. It was like one of her last things that she wrote. And when you look at that and you kind of look at where she was at in her life at that point in her, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you can really see a woman who's kind of come back to that original childlike understanding. of the character of Christ and what's important about that, that she had sitting in a church pew when she was 14 years old and heard Miller for the first time say, you know, it's all about the hope and healing, you know? So it's interesting. Like even she did that to herself, right? Like her, that she's come through all this period of time and, you know, whatever you believe about whether she did or didn't have visions from God. I think that's the lovely thing about the way that I treat those visions in the film. I don't show you any of the interior. There's no representation of that. You just see her and then you hear her talk about what she experienced with the people around her. And there's people that throw shade on that, that are skeptical about it. And I don't shy away from that because that's real life, right? Like right. we want to see the real challenge to, did God really show you that? And her husband says it, you know, at one stage when she's talking about, you know, we should dispense with meat and return to the diet of Eden. And her husband looks at her and goes, really? I mean,
she goes, it gets worse. There's sweet cakes too we can have or whatever.
And I don't go into this in the film, but there's like some great historical record. When they decided to do this as a family for real, she walked down the first morning where they're like, right, we're going to do breakfast and it's not going to be bacon and eggs today. And she walked downstairs and she sat at the table and she looked at the fruits and nuts and grains and just went, ugh, and walked back upstairs and went to bed.
And you got the son, you got one of her kids, you know,
eating beef jerky
in the outhouse, grabbing some beef because no one's looking.
And what I love about that is that, like, what it reveals to me is that, you know, so again, even the person who heard it direct from God, right, and recounts it back to everybody in her writings, struggles with whether or not she can live up to that mandate herself. I mean, there's something wholly fabulous about that, right? Like that, and that's very human. And what that says to me is, well, if she can persevere her way through that and she can wrestle with these like charges and, you know, like go and look at it for yourself and work out how you feel, you know, God wants you to live, then maybe I can persevere through some of that stuff myself, right? Maybe there's a chance for all of us. And I think that's the value of looking at people in real reality. Like if you hold up someone who is given the moniker or the position of prophet, right, if you hold them up on a pedestal, then they do become greater than what you're actually trying to, or what they're trying to shine light on and then move away from being focused on in the first place, right? You know, but when you see the fact that they argued with their spouse and, you know, like had terrible depression from a, you know, like feeling guilty because they went off and preached and abandoned their kids to some friends for months on end to look after them. One of their sons, Henry, who died at the age of 14, you know, one of her greatest disappointments and regrets in life that she reflects on in some of her writings later is that she basically was Auntie Ellen to her own son.
Well, she, you know, was preaching,
because she was preached, like she paid a heavy price personally and really reflected on that later on in life about, you know, why did I do this? Why did I mess this work-life balance up so badly? And again, I think that's a beautiful thing to us today, right? Like I reflect on that daily. I'm in a hotel room in Tampa right now and my family are fast asleep in Australia. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen them for 5 weeks. And you go, well,
oh, dear. Oh, dear.
You know, I spent a lot of time working on this film. Like, this is a passion. It's a mission that I feel called to get out and, like, have it be in cinemas and do, you know, the best that it can. But you pay a bit of a toll for that, right? Like, there's a price to be paid for, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but, again, you have to wrestle with that. Like, that's your own wrestle about, you know, like, how is my work-life balance going? Like, in 3 weeks, they're going to meet me in Los Angeles, so that's going to be great. We're going to get to, like, have holidays in America for a month together after the film comes out. But still, like, you're sacrificing 8 weeks of time with your family. You know, my kids are 9 and 11.
No, yeah.
A couple of hours on Zoom every now and again. Like, you start to realize every now and again, you have those moments where you find yourself in some great place in the world, looking out at a beautiful view going, I think I'd not rather be here. I think I'd rather be at home, right? Like that's reality. So I think when these people that have almost been mythologized become human again, and we're able to like relate to them and go, wow, like they still argued. One of my favorite scenes in the film, and Brett, the colorist, and I had a good laugh about this when we were color grading this scene. Because when we started it, he looked at me and said, "Man, I've had many conversations like that with my wife before." You know, and so it doesn't really matter what the specifics of that conversation are. It's like that, the recognizable, relatable thing where we've got this stuff that we want to do, these goals that we want to achieve, but we also have a life outside of that, right? And it's that tension between how do we balance those or not. And I think it's really healthy to see that and to sit in a cinema and go, man, who would I be in this story? You know, would I be the hero? Are there any actual heroes? Are we all just kind of struggling our way through and wrestling with these big issues of how do we see the character of God and then how do we relate that to other people? And I think that's the fabulous thing about cinema, right? Like, and it's why cinema is very, very different to watching it at home on Netflix, say, right? Nowhere but the cinema do you get to sit with 100 people and get that energy of everyone sitting there collectively mulling over and thinking through these things about who would I be and how would I react in a room together where all of our phones are off and we're forced because of just the way that cinema's constructed to pay attention to the story. That's why, and I love it. I love eating popcorn in there. I love hearing people shifting around. I love the energy that moves and shifts when something happens in the story and we're all affected by it. You know, that like nowhere else gives you that sense of community, right? With a story. And
And
then
I would
we've
think
spilt,
there's a lot
yeah.
of Seventh-day Adventists in America, and I would think they're going to be interested in seeing this film. You know, I would think that that would be. Have you been marketing to that denomination pretty heavily?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, you'd be silly not to, right? Like, it's their story as well. You know, like, this is what I love about filmmaking. It's a team sport, Rick. You know, there's, you can't make films on this scale by yourself. Like, you need collaborators. We've got two original songs in this film, which again is a little bit unique.
Yeah,
They are, they're
you had
written
like
by,
modern sounding songs in there in the middle of the three or four times throughout. How many
yeah, so
times would
the
we have a
two,
song? Would we have a song come in?
and it's really fascinating because it's not that we set out to do this. It's so Jonas Myron, who wrote, if you've ever sat in church and sung 10,000 Reasons or Cornerstone by Matt Redman, so that was written, you know, both those were written by Jonas Myron. He's prolific in the praise scene, and also writes for Andrea Bocelli and Lauren Daigle and Celine Dion, and you know, so he and I met on a film that we were both working on, and he was the musical director. I was in the writing team, in story room, and we had all these conversations about how we would love to, if we ever got the opportunity, to work with music and story, right? So not necessarily musical, but just how could music operate differently so that it's very much character driving and almost like the inward expression of character at really key moments where you kind of feel like you want to get a little bit more that you can't get from either sound effects or dialogue or visual. And so yeah, we got an opportunity to play. I sent him a really rough copy of the assembly really early on, which is really vulnerable, right? Because it's horrible at that
Oh
stage. It's
First
like you
cut's
make,
always bad. Always.
oh, and you're making all the
It's terrible.
excuses.
Too
Well, don't
long.
worry about this
It's
and
always
forget about
terrible.
that and da 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 da. But he was so inspired by that. I asked him to, well, see what comes out, you know, one song. And 4 days later, I got two of the most beautiful demos I've ever heard in my entire life. And so then they inspired me, and I scrapped all of the way that I was looking at the edit and the way that I was constructing the character arcs for the two main characters, Miller and Ellen. And I reworked them. And each of those songs has a three-act structure within those character arcs that tonally basically are charting where that character's at that particular moment. You know, so the expression of the song is unsure of itself and not quite sure of whether it's doing the right thing, when Miller's unsure of himself and not quite sure of whether he's doing the right thing. And then when he's bold and realizes that he needs to take this message further, it's bold and pushes you out into that journey. And then when he has that disappointment and realizes he's messed up, you know, it's really reflective and poignant. So, I mean, the way that we use those songs, and then with Ellen, those, you know, they're very much love theme, but then, you know, her theme goes somewhere very unexpected. And so because you have recognized that theme for her in a love context, when you see it for the last time, when it's that third act of the three-act structure of the song, I mean, it is just gloriously devastating because of that. And so it was just a lot of fun. Like we really had a great collaboration. Then when we got out of Pitcherlock into finishing post, Jonas and my composer, Blake Robinson, got re-inspired again because they saw how I'd layered those, just put those songs in and how I'd worked them. And then they just went to town playing again. And like then they got this beautiful way of expressing those moments musically and lyrically. It was one of the most inspiring processes, I think, of just people collaborating openly and being willing to share stuff in rough progress that enabled you to get just the good juice, right? The good oil of creative collaboration. And it really excites me when you get to do that, because it then ceases to be your thing and it becomes our thing. And every person that comes in, it becomes their film. And so, like, even, you know, it's hilarious to me that you've got this film about Adventists in the 1800s for whom it's the film of a whole group of industry professionals in Australia, in the Australian film industry, who, you know, just absolutely, this is their movie as much as it's mine, as much as it's any Adventist in a church out there at the moment, somewhere in the world. You know, it's really fun, and that suggests to you that those real human universal themes and wants and character desires and, you know, the things that we all wrestle with are really appealing. Like, you don't have to walk out of this movie and go, oh, I'm going to become a Seventh-day Adventist. But I hope that you'll be provoked and you go, wow, how am I taking the character of Christ out into the sphere of influence and the world that I operate in? You know, how am I speaking about my faith? You know, up until 2 years ago, you would never hear me talk about my faith, ever. I would never talk to you about it. And in fact, I was slightly like would downplay it because I didn't want it to interrupt and have people go, oh, he's a Christian filmmaker, right? Like, very much not wanting to highlight that in my life. And what's fascinating to me is like watching when you do get challenged because people are working on it and they come to you and go, Carl, just I'm working on this scene and I'm just really interested. What's your take on Sabbath? And you go, wow, no one's ever actually asked me that before in my entire life. Like, I'm 44 at the time sitting in the edit suite. And I'm like, how have I got 44 years into life and never once had someone ask me to explain why Sabbath? You know, and it challenges you and you go, okay, so for Kyle, the 44-year-old filmmaker at that point, what it is about is actually that healing thing again, right? Like, in, you know, the thing for me about Sabbath is really clear, right? It was made for man, not the other way around. So when you look at Sabbath in its full context, it's that rhythmic cycle of 24 hours of downtime where you don't have to worry about the responsibilities of the other 6 days of the week, and you don't have to stress about all these things that you have to do. And it just gives you an opportunity to stop. I was talking to one of my Israeli Jewish mates the other day, and she was saying to me, she challenged me on digital Sabbath, because they do digital Sabbath is a big thing in their house, where you just disconnect from all the technology. And I'm like, man, that's true, because the burden of your phone in modern society is a really big thing. So even just taking that 24-hour period out to taking just that disconnect.
Day. Yeah, well, it's a commandment, you know, keep the Sabbath holy. Yeah. This has been great. You know, I can hear the love of filmmaking in your voice.
Oh,
I can hear the joy that's there of just, you know, being able to work with these amazing people and collaborating, and these, what's happening now technologically, you're able to make things and film things that look like, you know, what would cost you 20, 30 million to do, you know? And so it's been great. We're talking about the film, The Hopeful, and it's in, it's a Fathom event, be in theaters the 17th and 18th of April. And, Kyle Portbury. Portbury.
Oh, look at that.
It's Portbury. And Kyle, thank you for your time. This has been such a pleasure and a joy, and appreciate all your heart. And again, that making this film about the advent of the beginnings of the Seventh Day Adventists, and how that came to be, you know, and a period piece that was not an easy lift. That's a heavy lift, brother. And, you know, and you did it. So thank you.
Thank you, Rick. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking time with us today. Thanks for listening today. Be sure to subscribe to the show and like us. Hey, would you tell a friend about the show? That would really help us out. You can find out more by going to faithfilmfan.com. That's faithfilmfan.com. I'm your host, Rick Altizer. We'll be back soon for another episode of the Faith Film Fan Podcast.